The United States of America, an exceptional and imperfect country. This is Brief Before Impact. Welcome, everyone. I am recording on the 4th of July, 2022. So let me wish everyone, I hope you had a terrific 4th of July weekend celebrating our great country with your family and friends, which prompted me to recording this episode about American exceptionalism. I feel like that title alone is going to be offensive to many. I doubt most of the people who listen to me on a regular basis will be too terribly offended, but I am going to tease out that phrase and dive into it. Probably do a two-part series. There's so much information to cover just thinking about what makes America exceptional, starting with the question, is it? On what basis am I making that claim, and et cetera? So today's episode, we're going to be evaluating 3 points, and this is all based around the founding of our country. First, that the American Revolution was just as much an economic revolution as it was political. Second, the convictions of the founding fathers. And finally, we'll discuss how does federalism function here in the United States? Before we get into it, let's take a quick ad break and we'll get to work. Hey, welcome back, everyone. Before I kick it off evaluating those 3 points that we were just discussing, I want to make just a quick word, a little off script. What, in fact, makes America the freest country in the world, or one of the freest? I want to highlight this idea of diving into our Constitution, specifically the structure and the components of our government. You know, for example, ask someone, what makes America great? Well, we've got the Bill of Rights and freedom of speech, freedom of press, et cetera, which are all, those are terrific, and those Bill of Rights are very important. However, a lot of countries around the world have a Bill of Rights. Even the Soviet Union had a Bill of Rights that was terrific, but it meant nothing. You know, it was on a piece of paper if it wasn't backed up by a formal structure that ensured those rights were respected. And this is where the United States is quite an exceptional country, because our Constitution prevents the centralization of power. It is the structure of our government that ensures those Bill of Rights are respected. Now, let's look at the structure of our legislative branch. You've got two houses, the Senate and the House of Representatives. Uniquely, these two bodies have significant amounts of power. In many European countries and parliamentary styles of democracies, one of those legislative bodies, they often have a bicameral legislative body, meaning bicameral, two houses. And one of those is typically almost doesn't really provide much value, I'll put it that way. Often you look at the UK, for example, the prime minister is almost, there's no separation in terms of the legislative body and his party and the prime minister's position. Here in the United States, counterly, you have the White House executive branch solely doing its own thing. And then over here, you've got the legislative bodies. This is unique to the United States. And as we'll dive in to throughout the podcast of how our structure of our government from the national down to the local level functions so well, it is in this fact that when you have these two legislative houses, the Senate and the House of Representatives, the way they interact often creates gridlock. Now, you'll hear people interviewed on the streets, just regular citizens, saying they're just frustrated with D.C., wish they would just do something. You know, what's with all this gridlock? The fact is, we should be thankful for the gridlock that exists in our federal government. The reason I say that is because gridlock often requires compromise. And whether you like it or not, no matter if you're on the political right or the political left, there are those individuals, American citizens with the same rights as you do, who are on the opposite side of the political spectrum. And they have buy-in to this whole thing too. So we get to have that compromise between the farthest left and the farthest right, and we end up with something in the middle, which generally, historically, has produced terrific results in the United States. Perfect? No, of course not. It is a continuing process that we try to excel for excellence in this country, and is in fact the structure of our government, that checks and balances in our federal branches that allows for this type of gridlock, more importantly, compromise between citizens of different parties and different outlooks on the world. So this is why I want to start off the United States in an extraordinary way. I'll even give you a quote from Alexis de Tocqueville, who was a French political philosopher right when America was being founded. And he said the following: "The greatness of America lies not in being more enlightened than any other nation, but rather her ability to repair her faults." This is so key. This is what makes America such a terrific place, is because despite its imperfections, we've had laws on the books that have prevented other human beings of different races to be valued the same as others. And through the process, the ability to repair our faults, we have over time, over centuries, improved, progressed, become better, become a more harmonious society together. There continues, and there will always be this this push and pull, and it will be very aggressive at times. But as in fact, highlighting the words of Tocqueville, it's that ability to fix those things, to compromise, to pull from the edges of either political extreme and find something that's harmonious in the middle for most majority of Americans. That is what makes this country so exceptional. So as I mentioned at the beginning, let me dive into these 3 points we're evaluating today, focusing on the founding of our country. We're going to talk about how the American Revolution was an economic revolution as much as it was political first. Second, convictions of the founding fathers. Finally, federalism and how it functions in America. This whole topic, the founding of our country, that's a podcast to itself, a 10-point series. There are far better podcast hosts out there doing this stuff in more depth. But I today just want to give you just a taste of what led the United States to being created. Because I feel in this modern climate of political rhetoric, we're missing the point of why we got started in this thing in the first place. And how can you possibly evaluate where you are or where you want to go as a nation if you can't even understand where you came from? Because those common threads of how this country was founded, they are through a timeline and they touch each of us. Anyone listening, and myself included, we are all touched by the philosophy that founded our country. It has shaped who we are. We might love parts of it, we might not like parts of it, but that is in fact where we came from and how we crafted our ideas about the political process. So let's start off with evaluating how the American Revolution was in fact as much of an economic revolution, something that the founding fathers decided that based upon grievances and their lack of representation, they had to push against the monarchy and Great Britain. And I want to highlight a terrific piece written by Robert Wright, who's a chair of political economy at Augusta University. And he walks us through this time of the early colonial economy pre-Revolutionary War. And he writes, "The colonial economy boomed during the French and Indian War. But by the war's end, real estate prices, buoyed by a surfeit of money and low interest rates, had doubled and in some places even tripled those real estate prices. After the war, however, the economic situation reversed dramatically. Gone was the specie taken from the French or the circulated by British troops stationed in North America. So more bills of credit were pulled from circulation via planned taxation than were actually emitted. So as this money supply plummeted, interest rates soared, and this forced real estate prices ever downward, and they eventually to a half or even a third of their highest point, which is backed before the wars even started. So by 1765, private mortgages began falling due to on properties bought at inflated prices during the war, and therefore mass bankruptcies ensued. So how did the British respond to this economic distress? Colonists in the United States appealed to the mother country for aid, but at every turn, She tightened the screws rather than relieving that stress. And the first came on with onerous trade restrictions. Those restrictions that cramped even the extensive intra and intercolonial trade. Cut off from the traditional trading partners abroad, the colonists could not earn sufficient foreign exchange abroad. So next came the Currency Act, which made it unlawful for the colonies to issue any more fiat paper money. The shortage of money became so acute in some places that money substitutes appeared. A lot of substitutes being like handwritten IOUs. Now, peeved that the British policymakers would not provide the essence of economic freedom, the protection of their lives, liberty, and property, colonists vigorously resisted the Stamp Act, which required them to pay a tax on any printed material that encompassed everything from legal documents to newspapers. And this isn't just mere conjecture, as several colonists clearly and explicitly linked the Stamp Act controversy to the post-war economic fiasco. So you can see this momentum building up prior to the revolution of this economic collapse ongoing in the colonies. And whenever the colonists reached out to the king in England, they weren't having it. They treated the colonies like second-class citizens, which the colonists certainly did not like. They weren't being represented in these kind of decisions at the parliament, which made them quite upset. They weren't able to have any type of voice, and especially when at home they were having so many economic struggles. And this really moves into how the founding fathers, their attitude as they were creating our founding documents, how they were taught, how they were writing letters to each other, how they even had the conversations prior to July 4th of 1776, and what moved them. And worse, you won't hear me talk about the military campaigns or anything like that in terms of the kinetic battlefield environment or the troops in the United States and so forth, but rather it was the ideas. What were the ideas that made these men take the underlying economic challenge that they were enduring and move away from, we are no longer going to be second-class citizens of the greatest power the world had ever known at that point, to now we're going to found our own country, which is a radical idea to conceive. Even if you could just try to imagine yourself in your shoes, your whole life, imagine you were one of the founding fathers. You're rather young, highly educated compared to some of your peers in society. Many entrepreneurs and businessmen, including lawyers as well, and observing the landscape of their colonies, feeling less and less British and more uniquely American, they came up with this idea that they could far better lead their own communities politically and become an independent power. So I want to discuss the convictions of our founding fathers. You know, what led them to having such confidence that this was the right thing to do? What led Thomas Jefferson to write and pen the words that he did that we all have read so many times on the Declaration of Independence? And more importantly, for these men who had so much on the line, so much at stake, to kind of put and push all their chips to the middle of the table and go all in on independence. I want to present a terrific piece written by Scott Powell for the Dallas Morning News as he highlights the attitude at the time and the conviction of our founding fathers as independence was becoming a true kinetic movement throughout the colonies. And Powell writes, "What prompted the Continental Congress to begin displaying all 56 signatures," he's referring to the signatures in the Declaration of Independence, "that can be traced to General Washington's rebound at the Battle of Trenton, which was a remarkable victory. The founding fathers realized that this could be a turning point, a harbinger of ultimate military victory. So, perhaps taking to heart the last sentence of the Declaration, quote, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortune, and our sacred honor. The Continental Congress began posting fully signed copies throughout the 13 colonies in January of 1777. Think about that for a moment. Let me interject. Prior to this, there was this notion that the independence was happening. You know, there were multiple battles going on, particularly in Massachusetts. So this was spreading throughout the colonies that this was ongoing. And now this news of a declaration of independence is out, traveling via papers. And as the months progressed from July 4th to several months later, to January 1777, the founders said, we have to be all in and put our names on this thing. Obviously, we've signed it. Now we got to let the inspire the country and our fellow countrymen that we are in this as much as they are. So Powell continues writing, if we take seriously the word selected in the Declaration of Independence to mobilize support for the cause, we can see that the founding fathers placed everything on the line and trusted the Almighty for the results. As this esteemed British historian, Paul Johnson, notes, quote, the Americans were overwhelmingly church-going, much more so than the English, whose rule they rejected. There is no question that the Declaration of Independence was, to those who signed it, a religious as well as a secular act. And this is such a fascinating point whenever I start thinking about it. Whenever you're working on a team, for example, you're always trying to get your team members to have a buy-in to what the team is doing. How do they believe that they're just as much of a part of it as you are if you're leading that team? And this example of how the founders viewed what they were doing wasn't just, okay, this is a political act, we need to change tax policy in the colonies. No, they viewed it as a religious act, something that was deeply held as the right, righteous thing to do. And Powell continues, what was truly revolutionary was not just the colonies' ultimate success in their war for independence, but the colonies' assertion in the Declaration of Independence that the rights of the people come from God and not the state. And because rights come from God, they are absolute and inalienable, and that state's authority has to be limited to not infringe those rights. No other nation in history, perhaps with the exception of ancient Israel, was founded in such a way that the sovereignty of the state was limited by its people's inalienable rights. And this simple idea put into practice enabled the United States' ascendance from a colonial poverty to global superpower in a little more than 200 years. I think Powell's hitting a fascinating note. I think that gives us a direct insight into what the founders' convictions and beliefs were. Because to them, it wasn't merely the home country and the motherland and our king and our monarch was treating us in a poor way and taxing us without representation. But rather, they believe inherently that men and women have a right to live in a certain way, because by the laws of nature, the creator that created that nature, they have certain rights as human beings. And those rights cannot be trampled or dismissed by some kind of political body. And this viewpoint, this defines how America was founded, how Americans continue to think 200 plus years later. How often do you hear both citizens and politicians alike talking about pushing back against government overreach or, executive power and how it's infringing the rights of the individual citizen, That principle continues on and on, centuries now later. And it's because there's that common thread, that belief in Americans, starting with our founders to modern times, of how we have rights that are not found by a government or by a monarchy or some king or dictator, but rather because we are in fact human beings, we have rights defined by God. Therefore, those cannot be infringed. Those cannot be trampled. And it is the responsibility of the people to keep its government in check, to ensure its rights are not infringed upon, because those rights are absolutely inalienable. So with that concept and those beliefs in the minds of our founders, how did they go from this basis of principles to actually creating a structure of government that would make it through the early days of independence and live on to 200 plus years later successfully for different times and different generations to enjoy and to endure. And I want to highlight this in some detail, what federalism actually is and how it operates here in the United States. I'm going to read you a brief piece coming from Duke Law School. Reflecting on America's early political development, Alexis de Tocqueville commented, quote, "In America, it may be said that the township was organized before the county before the state before the union." America's earliest political associations were forged at the local level. Early colonists found themselves separated from their sovereign's authority and protection by a vast ocean, and from their fellow colonists by vast geographic expanse. The colonies, they're huge in terms of miles between each colony. And as a consequence, they organized and largely governed their day-to-day lives independently and locally. The need for some degree of centralization among the various colonies became clear during the Revolutionary War. The demands of raising the army, putting it under a central command, supplying it, raising funds for it, exceeded just state and local government capabilities. The revolutionaries recognized that some confederation was needed, but they remained deeply suspicious of centralized power. The implications of failure were not lost on the revolutionaries. In 1775, Silas Deane wrote to Patrick Henry that, quote, "If a reconciliation with Great Britain takes place, it will be obtained on the best terms by the colonies being united and be the more like to be preserved on just and equal terms. If no reconciliation is to be had without a confederation, we are ruined to all intents and purposes. The wartime urgency and the necessity of union, combined with the fear of new or overarching sovereign, led the revolutionaries to ratify the Articles of Confederation, March 1, 1781. Now, the Articles left the states as the source of sovereign power, but created a new central government with its powers derived from the consent of the states. So America is a bottom-up idea. Local communities first, and then the government from the local, state, and federal level builds up from that point. And the authority of that federal government comes from the people and the consent of the states. Now, the Articles proved unworkable. Disputes among states were difficult to resolve, and the central government was underfunded and unable to compel delinquent states to pay their shares of common expenditures. So the solution the framers posited and states adopted was the federalism embodied in the Constitution. Quote, "The framers split the atom of sovereignty. The genius of their idea was that American citizens would have two political capacities, one state and one federal, each protected from incursion by the other." One scholar has described this federalism, quote, "as a new modeled creation cobbled together out of a mix of necessity and theory." The necessity, that's the existence of the states. The theory, the belief that republics could not be easily maintained across a large territory. It's the basic structural characteristics of this more perfect union form the basis of the system of American government that continues to present. Like I mentioned earlier, this episode tonight hardly does justice over the topic of early American history, certainly its founding. But my intention was to give the basis of almost a counter argument to what I keep seeing on both social media and traditional media, which is challenging this idea that America was ever good in the first place, or it's even worth defending now. There are those in the political commentary who believe that the systems of government that we have cannot be amended or adjusted, changed. Legislation can't be written that could fix certain aspects of American life. So the answer is to tear down the system itself. I completely disagree with that notion. I think that is an immature and ill-conceived idea. And in fact, the system has allowed Americans for over two centuries to repair itself. Like Tocqueville said, America has the ability to repair her faults. And I wanted to maintain this narrative, this idea that the founders and modern Americans have so much alike. Because ultimately, I believe anyone who at least listens to this podcast believes that it is that individual liberty that each of us has to pursue anything we want, whether it's owning a business or working for someone else, living where we please, move from one state to another. We don't like the politics of a state out on the coast, we move to the middle, or vice versa. It's whatever you want to do, and you have that ability in the United States. And more importantly, you have the ability that the local community, the township, the city, the state, they have so much of its own autonomy and cannot be dominated by the federal government. And we see in recent political developments, the states getting more of their own power back from rulings from the United States Supreme Court. Because that's what United States is as a structure, as a foundation. The local government has the voice. It is the consent of those states that gives the federal government its power. I hope you enjoyed this brief explanation of America's founding, and I hope you found it useful. Share it with a dear friend or who would also enjoy it, or even perhaps a young person who hasn't read or listened to this kind of analysis or history of our country's founding. I mean, this 20 or 30 minute or so podcast, it doesn't do the topic justice, but it might just be enough to cultivate the interest of someone looking for clarity on the subject to go out and do a little more research and reading their own to challenge the ideas that I presented. At least that was my intention for tonight. So thanks for joining me for another episode. Happy 4th of July, celebrating the greatest country in the world. As always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.